You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Danny and Derek.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Are you the American Prestige guys? Is this the every 2 months podcast collaboration between Non-Zero Podcast and the American Prestige Podcast?
The award-winning American Prestige Podcast.
Did you guys win an award?
We won two.
What are they? And who? And how many people have heard of these awards?
Almost nobody, except for the people we told about it.
It was a real award. It's the Signal Awards. We beat PodSave.
Oh, yes, the famous
show.
Signal Awards. You know, every year I can't decide because they run at the same time as the Academy Awards, and I'm like, Academy.
Well, no one gives a shit about the Academy Awards. No one gives a shit about any of these awards anyway. I think the Academy Awards has also been in terminal decline. Awards are in terminal decline, but we did win them. We beat PodSave, Jon Stewart, and a Daily Wire show.
Let's be honest about this. We beat them in the Listener Choice Award, but Jon Stewart got a gold medal and we only got a silver medal. So
that's serious, though, man. How come nobody ever mentions me in this context of like
you have to pay to submit your show?
Oh, the truth comes out. A little payola thing going on. Oh, well, congratulations anyway. Well, listen, I'm speaking of the Academy Awards and actors and so on. I'm glad you guys won this thing because maybe that will compensate for the devastating blow to Danny's self-esteem that was done in a recent podcast. I don't want to dwell on this right now. I want to get back to it, but I think you know what I'm talking about, Danny. You had famous actor Morgan Spector on your podcast. I listened to it. You know, he stars in The Gilded Age. Turns out he has pretty deep interest in foreign affairs. And at some point, he said something that I could tell set Danny back a little bit, kind of a crushing blow.
And what was that,
ego,
Bob?
Am I right?
Remind the audience.
Well, I think this is an exact quote. Tell me if it's either a paraphrase or an exact quote. He says, "Danny, frankly, the only reason I'm even talking to you is in hopes that you'll introduce me to Robert Wright." Was that what he said, or was it? It was like
he actually said Paul Bloom, not Robert Wright, but that's what I heard.
Anyway, he said he's a fan of these every 2 months podcasts. And he said favorable things about my emphasis on international law.
Yes.
And since that always, you always contest that. You found this threatening. You push back. We'll get back to
it.
It was terrible to see. This is probably why
he never replied to my message on Instagram thanking him for doing the show. But Morgan, if you're listening to this, please respond to
Actually, it's funny. When that message arrived, when that message arrived on his smartphone, I was having lunch with him. He flew to New Jersey to have lunch with me. We'll get back to the subject because there are real issues of substance here, even aside from the very important issue of Danny's self-esteem. But first...
Already too high.
What? So Trump returns triumphantly from China after also saying he's going to resume the testing of nuclear weapons. Is that a fair...
I mean, yeah, he was going to claim triumph with this, you know, meeting with Xi, no matter what happened, I think. But I think the outcome of that is somewhat shocking because it was China doing to the U.S. something that the U.S. typically does to other countries, which is manufacturing its own leverage and then getting the U.S. to knuckle under in exchange for giving up stuff that it really hadn't even started to do yet or had only been doing for the last few months. I mean, like what I've seen of the trade deal that they reached was China agreed to drop its embargo basically on buying U.S. soybeans and agreed to suspend its restrictions on rare earth or critical minerals trades for at least a year and got meaningful concessions from Trump in response to that. I mean, those two policies are things that she had only introduced, you know, in the past few months in response to the trade war. So he's really not giving up anything that's like a long-standing Chinese position. And in return for that, he got tariff reductions. He got, you know, he got meaningful concessions out of Trump. And I don't think really gave up anything. So it was interesting to me to sort of look at that.
Well, Bob, I mean, before you jump in, I just want to point people to, you did a really good episode on the China trade war, Non-Zero. So I'd actually point people toward that. I learned a lot
Paul
on that.
Triolo.
Yeah, yeah, that was really good. That really, I learned a lot from that episode. So people who want a deep dive on that and just how sort of this has been so driven by the United States, check out that episode.
Yeah, I mean, that especially emphasizes the chip war, the tech restrictions, and the rare earth retaliation, which was construed largely as a retaliation for the chip restrictions. And defenders of Trump would say is, okay, he reduced the tariffs on China by 10% and dropped this ridiculous 100% new tariffs threat that nobody sane took seriously to begin with. But he didn't, so far as we know yet, cave on the chip restrictions issue. There had been concern among people who favor the chip restrictions that he was going to give, let them buy these the Blackwell generation of NVIDIA chips. And I haven't heard about any concession in that realm. So they'll be happy. And I guess that's what you'll say in his defense, is that if you construe the rare earth thing as retaliation for the chips, and it was in the same realm, then I don't know, somehow Trump wins. But yeah, I think you're right, Derek. I'm perfectly happy for it to have happened. I mean, reduce the tariffs a little on China. They're still 45%. But it's not a big deal. Now, I would say the same thing about this headline that accompanied it, which is Trump's, based on Trump's declaration last night, as he approached the summit, I guess, with Xi, that he was going to resume nuclear testing. Here's what he said. It, as we'll see, makes kind of no sense, is barely even intelligible what he's talking about, because he says, quote, on social media, he says, quote, because of other countries' testing programs, I've instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. Well, Russia hasn't tested a nuclear weapon in like a decade. China, it's been even longer. You might ask, what the hell's he talking about? Russia apparently tested a nuclear-powered missile.
Correct.
So in other words, they have tested nuclear weapons in the sense that we are testing, or actually, I guess, using a nuclear weapon every time one of our nuclear-powered submarines goes anywhere, right?
Correct.
It's the equivalent of like a civilian nuclear reactor that you use for energy. Now, it may be something to worry about, but it has nothing to do with the testing of nuclear weapons at all. And then he kind of doubled down this after the summit. He says, we have more nuclear weapons than anybody. We've halted it many years ago. We don't do testing. We've halted testing. But with others doing testing, I think it's appropriate that we do it also. So I think nothing will come of this except that media outlets will get a lot of traffic because it's such a great headline. I don't know.
It's hard to say. I mean, I think you're right. He's misconstruing either like somebody told him Russia tested a nuclear powered missile and all he heard was nuclear missile, mm-hmm. or like, you know, people in his, you know, advisor group are intentionally, you know, misinforming him that this is something other than what it was. But I do think this is what he's latched onto. I mean, he didn't explain himself, so it's hard to know to a certainty, but that's the only thing that's happened recently that you could, you know, sort of even construe as a nuclear weapons test. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think we're going to start blowing up nukes in the South Pacific again anytime soon, but who knows? I mean, it was just out of the blue for him to make that announcement, and clearly, yeah, there's it doesn't make sense when you know consider it from any vantage point other than Trump's, I think.
Yeah, but his his crazy whims do have a way of acquiring momentum. I just, a couple of weeks ago, I listened to a podcast on the Golden Dome space-based missile defenses. Mm. And it was a conversation with a guy from the American Enterprise Institute. So I thought, oh no, he's going to love this thing. I'll brace myself. And this guy's a true expert. He says, this is fucking crazy, basically. He says, like, he explains, like, how because all of the space-based things are constantly in motion, it's not the part of orbit that stays stationary with respect to the Earth. So if you really want the coverage you need, you got to have, like, 8 jillion things out there that can shoot stuff down because, they're, you know, it's doing it during the ascent stage. It's complicated. But when AEI says... your hawkish program is crazy. It's crazy.
That's pretty, yeah, that's pretty stark.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of think tanks, did you guys see that RAND report, which was like, oh, we should try to coexist with China because we're not going to be, I mean, this is genius stuff coming from the brain of the military industrial complex. Not to insult your firm or workplace, Derek.
Well, but, yeah, we'll talk about it offline. I was a very junior person at RAND in there.
Yeah, that's not a secret, right? That's not a secret.
Social science. No, we talked about it on the show before. Well, I mean, it's how I got into it. It was like how I got into like the Middle East. We had a project in Qatar that I worked on that was supposed to transform their education system. Didn't really, I don't think, do that. But like that was my gateway to, like that was the first time I had lived outside the US, and you know, was a lot of firsts for me to be on that project, and got me to go into grad school in Middle East studies, and here I am. So
got you to waste your life. Terrible life decision after terrible life decision. Yeah, but that report was pretty funny because it's been so obvious for so long that the United States is not going to be able to remain even a major power, I think, in East Asia in 20-ish years. And so I found that report kind of fascinating. Even the military intellectual complex is now recognizing things for what they are.
Yeah, I mean, Derek, given what you know about RAND, what's your take? I mean, when I think of RAND, I mean, first of all, like a lot of places, they do a lot of reports that are in effect on contract, right? Somebody, they have donors, they have, sometimes they're actual, maybe just research contracts, I don't know. So they do different things that may reflect the interests of the donors. But even that aside, I always kind of thought of RAND vaguely as having a little bit of a realist vibe that could be redeeming in some context.
Yeah, like right now with China.
So, I mean, Danny can talk to this better than I can. I never worked on the military side of stuff, and back then, I was not like I wouldn't really have understood what realist versus, you know, anything else was. This was like, you know, I was doing like not a lot of, you know, foreign related stuff at that point. I was doing like economic development work in Pittsburgh. So,
right, yeah, they have an office in Pittsburgh. Not because of Carnegie Mellon, I think. Right, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually wrote my first book, Bob, is on the formation of RAND. But yeah, no, you're basically right. I would say RAND is one of the better ones. I think it tends to genuinely value its quote-unquote objectivity. And we, of course, all know that that's impossible. But still, it is generally better than a partisan-associated think tank. It really does value itself as being nonpartisan and looking out for the U.S. national interest. So I do think that effectively it'd be difficult to work there if you're not on some level a primacist. But I also do think that they are genuinely more sophisticated and more objective when it comes to analyzing the United States' role in the world. So to me, this does actually indicate something. It does indicate that there is a recognition amongst the brain of the empire that things are changing. They're not going to return to normal, which is a shift from in the last 10 years when you have people like Ivo Dalder and James Lindsay writing books like The Empty Throne about how the United States needs to reaffirm itself and rule the world now until the end of time. I think people are recognizing that that's not going to happen. And so you're going to see an accommodation to particularly Chinese power in East Asia. Now, what that results in is difficult to know. I mean, my longstanding fear for years now is that China will do something particularly aggressive, whether it's invade Taiwan or something else, and the US will just be like, see you later, leaving allies in the lurch. So a report like this could actually prevent something like that from happening, but where you'll actually see sort of a genuine security and economic transition that's more planned than what might otherwise have occurred. So that was my general take on the report. Derek, I don't know if you disagree or agree with that.
No, I mean, I think that's that's it. I mean, this is sort of signaling this probably is a good place to also talk about the Bill Gates thing, because I think that's similarly kind of signaling that we're going to accommodate to the world rather than trying to change it. It's an acknowledgement that China is here, and it's powerful, and it's powerful in a way that the U.S. can't really do anything correct about. So you have to just try to coexist with it, or, you know, World War III, and that would be another solution, I guess, to a lot of things, but, not ideal, certainly.
You guys are a little more optimistic than I am about the China vibe changing soon within the American foreign policy establishment, but I hope you're right.
It's going to take a while, right? It's not going to filter into this administration. It's going to
be under 40, 45, I would say. Yeah, people under 45. Essentially, I think have a genuinely different view.
My generation can blow up the world long before they take
that. Well, you guys want to be the last people on Earth, you know, so it makes sense. Why it can't exist after the baby boomers, so there you go.
We want to be the last Medicare recipients on Earth.
Well, that's already happening. You see, I don't know if you saw it. This was in a tweet, so maybe it's incorrect, but apparently like healthcare costs are going to be jumping to like $4,000 premiums a month, which basically makes it impossible to have healthcare. So there's going to be some social crisis.
The ACA is going to just break down, I think.
Yeah, it's just going to break down. Yeah. I love all those reports from the early 2010s where they're like, the ACA is the greatest thing to ever occur in the United States. Couldn't get that Medicare for all. Got to go with a market-based solution. Good stuff.
Oh, well. The revolution will come, Danny. I haven't given up.
I don't think it will. That's the problem.
Revolution. Bill Gates. I read what he actually said. It wasn't, when I first saw the headlines, you know, Gates says we'll whatever survive climate change, I thought, is he just buying into the AI line that like it's like data centers, Uber, Alles? And, you know, and it is kind of funny. That alone is kind of funny because in Silicon Valley, not so long ago, the secular religion was almost climate change. It's like the one thing everyone in Silicon Valley agreed on is that it's an existential threat and we got to do something about it.
Right. And but then, the line was, we got to do something about it. But the thing that we're going to do is, you know, some magic technology that we develop, you know, in 10 years is going to suck all the carbon out of the air. Like it wasn't. Like, we have to stop using coal and oil right now.
But they were on that. They weren't denying. They were fine with that and even support. I mean, I think it was kind of like conventional climate change policy plus, I would say. But now it's just a plus. Now it's like, no, you don't understand. AI is going to solve climate change. We just have to unleash it. Look, it's not impossible. I mean, AI is going to advance science. But it is kind of funny to see. Anyway, Gates is doing something a little subtler than that, right?
Bob, can I actually pause? Yeah. Can I actually ask you a question about that before we turn to Gates? Because you just wrote a book on this. What do you mean by AI is going to advance science? Like, how does that work? Genuine question. How is an LLM going to do that?
Well, there have already been. I recount an example in my book where... they send the results of this AI thing. I think it was Google. Google set up this, it's like an interactive thing, I think, among different LLMs.
Okay.
But they generated a hypothesis and they sent it to this expert. And he's like, have you been stealing our email? And actually it was Google, so it's possible. But basically he said, we haven't published this yet. But yeah, this is something we were on to. And he looked at the other-
That's not generating. That's not generating. That's basically stealing from someone else's email.
No, it's not. No. Google didn't really steal his fucking email. That was a joke.
Think they monitored it? I mean, come on. You don't think they had access to it?
No, I don't.
Really? Look,
anyway, independent of that, Nathan LeBenz does this Cognitive Revolution podcast. And he, like me, is very concerned about AI. You know, it's odd that this is a kind of unusual combination to think it's going to be very, very powerful and be very concerned about it. I mean, the sci-fi doomers fit that description. But so many of the leftist critics of AI, they're both like, you know, they worry about it and claim that it's super hyped and isn't really going to amount to anything.
I don't think that. I mean, AI could be a good thing if we didn't live in capitalism, right? It's clearly a labor-saving device.
Nathan had somebody on who was talking about, I think it was it is actually discovered, I believe, new antibiotics or a new kind of synthetic antibody. Anyway, it's something real. It's absolutely happening.
But what was it? Could you just explain the mechanism? If it's basically just a predictive model, does it discover? That's basically my question.
First of all, it isn't just large language models per se. I mean, Google's AlphaFold thing, the protein folding predictor thing, which I don't totally understand, that advances science. I haven't seen any actual miracle cures emerge, but everybody seems to agree that is accelerating progress. I mean, this is not a big emphasis of mine. I can't, you know, without looking
I'm
at
it. I'm just curious because it can't do history because it would have to go to archives. So I'm just curious, like, what is the mechanism? It just reads every scientific paper. And then based on reading every scientific paper, it would make a prediction. I'm just trying to literally figure out the mechanism of progress.
Sometimes they give it guidance and say, here's the problem. But with AlphaFold, it's totally different.
I don't know. Yeah,
this is going to happen. I mean, as for history, I don't know what you mean, but it can go to the archives if they're digitized.
If they're digitized, then most of them aren't. I hate to say, there's not a lot of funding for digitizing archives these days. So the overwhelming majority of archival materials have not been digitized. Mm-hmm. So it would only be able to use the digit, which would give obviously a very skewed understanding of any historical events. But science might be different. I don't know. I guess you would have to run some sort of experimentation. I don't quite see how it'd be able to test the hypothesis. I could see it doing math stuff. You know, particularly like Yen used to write about this very advanced physics stuff with string theory, which is essentially mathy. It's kind of, you know, philosophy almost. But I'm genuinely curious how it would make a genuine scientific advance. I don't quite see how a predictive model could do that. The AlphaFold stuff ironies, I'm not familiar with.
A lot of ironies here that have to do with which model of AI prevailed. What prevailed is kind of deep learning neural networks. And partly as a result, it's like the math stuff is at least as challenging for them as a lot of other stuff. I mean, like 2 + 2 turned out to be a challenge for large language models. They're getting around that. And it is doing amazing things in math. I mean, it won the gold medal in the recent math Olympiad or whatever. I don't know. But trust me, it's going to be an earthquake. My book.
No, I agree. I think it's going to be a huge earthquake. I think it's going to really affect labor. I do not agree with leftist critics who think it's bullshit. I do not agree with that at all. I mean, the question would be, we should live in a world where labor-saving devices like that don't just mean people are out of work. You know, the Marxist dream is to save time on labor that you don't need to do. That's why Marx was, you know, two cheers for capitalism a little bit. But we don't live in that world, obviously. I think people will just lose jobs and that'll be that.
Okay, before we get back to Gates, thanks for the book plug opportunity. It's called The God Test, comes out. Late in the spring, yes. The God Test. Is that cosmic enough?
That's good. So how many of your book titles got in it now? Two of six?
Three of six.
So 50%.
In one case, it's
God. You're God-pilled. You're God-pilled.
I am. Gates. He says, climate change, disease, and poverty are all major problems. We should deal with them in proportion to the suffering they cause. So he says he's arguing for a reallocation of resources toward, you know, saving lives in the near term, which is interesting because in a way that aligns with a leftist critique of effective altruism, right? Like effective altruists are sometimes accused of focusing so much on long-term distant existential risks that they're ignoring contemporary problems. In a way, Gates is doing the opposite.
Yes. That, I mean, the critique
that's a straw
that
man
I've seen
you
of,
can now knock down.
The critique I've seen of effective altruism is that the problems that they create for themselves are like so sci-fi and like absurd that it just becomes an excuse not to do anything.
Well, yeah. The critique is very obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's literally just laundering selfishness.
What I think he's doing subtly here is saying, look, like, and you know, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, said this already. You know, the COP30 climate summit's coming up next month, and he did an interview with The Guardian this week and basically said, like, look, we've missed the Paris target, 1.5 degrees mm-hmm. Celsius of warming. There's no chance we're gonna stand or that at this point. So we have to, this is like a call to arms, you know, because every tenth of a degree above that is, you know, more and more disasters, more extreme weather, more, you know, people mm-hmm. displaced, more this, more that. And, you know, Gates is sort of talking about the same thing, but it's sort of, you know, it's kind of, you know, I think subtly saying, like, look, we're not going to solve this. We're not going to solve it. The thing that might solve it is, again, some magic technology that we, you know, don't have right now that we might have someday. But short of that, you know, we just need to accommodate ourselves to the fact that the world is getting warmer and more difficult for people to live in. And we need to address the effects rather than worrying about preventing or mitigating the causes, which I think is a pretty big shift. For a big mm-hmm. philanthropist like him. And it, you know, he's not coming right out and saying that, but I think that's the general meaning of what he's talking about.
And here's a question, like, how many professed climate change warriors are complaining about, for example, a 1,000,000% tariff on all these very cheap electric cars that China would be more than happy to sell us? I mean, they're unbelievably right. cheap. They're unbelievably cheap. And both us and Europe have basically walled ourselves off from them. You know, at the beginning of, you know, decades ago, I wrote actually a cover editorial for the New Republic in 1988, when this first really became a big thing, because this guy at NASA, this scientist, testified before Congress about it. And the issue from the beginning was like, okay, so the problem is like getting nations to make short-term sacrifices, investments, whatever. It's like a collective action problem. Who's going to pony up? Who's going to curtail the car? Blah, blah, blah. So China, like, now maybe it was just industrial policy and they were just thinking about long-term dominance of markets, but for whatever reason, they invested a shitload of subsidies in these technologies, solar panels, electric cars. And so in principle, you would say, well, thank you for taking the lead.
Right.
But no, we're saying we don't. No, we refuse to buy any of this shit.
I mean, not just that. I mean, we've gone in the opposite direction. Like, you know, the talk used to be like, can the U.S. and Europe do enough to mitigate climate change if China is going to keep burning coal? Like, that used to be the big thing. Like, there's nothing really, we can't do enough to on our own to solve this problem if China keeps burning coal. And then China pivoted, you know, to embrace renewable energy and is now leading the world in all of this stuff. But it's the U.S. that's gone 180 degrees. I mean, the election of Donald Trump was the end of any climate remediation or mitigation for the
tariffs,
U.S.
The tariffs I'm talking about are Biden tariffs, by and large, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm not singling Trump out. I'm just saying, yeah. Like, that was really, like, if there was a death knell for the U.S. doing anything about climate, like, that was it. And that now we're in the reverse situation where, you know, there's only so much that China can do on its own to embrace renewable energy and reduce carbon emissions. If the U.S. is going to be, you know, rolling coal for the next 4 years, that's ball game.
And mm-hmm. and Bob, just to your point, I think we recently had Nick Mulder on the podcast who studies sanctions. He's a Cornell historian, but he does a lot of contemporary stuff. And he had a good point in a forthcoming episode about how energy control and how one uses energy is a typical way that empires govern. So I think something like this actually gets to the heart of U.S. global leadership, which partially explains why the walling off has occurred. That this really strikes at the heart of empire in a way that other things don't quite. And mm-hmm. I think this really indicates that. Like you said, from basically any perspective, unless you're an American automaker, this would be a good thing. You could get cheaper cars and they would be a benefit to the climate. But it strikes at the heart of the American project since 1945. And so there's not going to be much support for it in the halls of power.
Mm-hmm. So, meanwhile, Gaza, I see Israel is sticking with its 100-to-1 death ratio of Palestinians and Israelis. One Israeli soldier was killed. I don't even think it's actually clear whether Hamas did it. They denied they did it. But anyway, so there ensued strikes that actually did kill, I think, 100 people, including women and children, right?
I was just wondering about that, but yes, the overnight strikes. I mean, it's look, I found this all kind of absurd, and I did want to read to you a headline that Reuters went with earlier today. They changed the headline. Go figure. But the headline is Israel carries out new strikes in Gaza after asserting commitment to ceasefire. Like, that should be in the Onion. But that's where we are. I mean, this is mm-hmm. where we're at. The ceasefire, as it always is in these situations in Gaza, in Lebanon, the Israeli take on any of these ceasefires is you cease, we fire. Like, mm-hmm. there's nothing in this that the Israelis feel obligated to uphold. One soldier is killed, and we don't know the circumstances around that. We don't know who they were fighting. They blamed Hamas. Hamas says it had nothing to do with it. There are units that it claims are in Rafah, which is where that incident took place, that it has no contact with, like it's been out of touch with for months, which is conceivable. I mean, you know, take it or leave it when they make a claim like that. But this could have been, you know, a relatively isolated incident. And even if it was Hamas, even if there was a clash that like Hamas senior leadership ordered and one Israeli soldier was killed, to turn around and then kill 110 people, almost half of them kids, in retaliation is just absurd. I mean, it makes absolutely, there's no justification for it. There's no justification for a ceasefire where you're repeatedly killing, you know, 5, 3, 5, 10 people every day on a normal day, let alone what happened over the last, you know, couple of days. So it's nonsense. It's a non-existent ceasefire from the perspective of the Israelis. And to say that they're committed to it, or that they're resuming their commitment to it, which is what they said on Wednesday. You can't resume something that you were never participating in the first place. It's just, go ahead. Sorry.
And one other thing quickly on that. I mean, first of all, J.D. Vance said, yeah, an Israeli soldier was killed by Hamas or possibly some other actor. So he acknowledges we don't even know.
Right.
And then he says, and yeah, Israel can be expected to respond. Well, nominally, they were attacking Hamas. In a sense, it doesn't matter who they blame, because I think they're basically, you know, often just targeting any military age males they see and any women and children in the vicinity get killed. But
They're targeting, first and foremost, they're targeting anybody who encroaches on the so-called yellow line, which we don't, doesn't even appear to be well marked, but this is the line, you know, that the Israelis have drawn on a map to say, you know, we're going to sit on 55% or whatever it is of Gaza, mm-hmm. and the rest of this is where you people can live. And, yeah. you know, anybody who crosses that line gets shot at. There was a debate in the Israeli cabinet about this, and you know, you had cabinet ministers saying, well, you know, we shouldn't shoot at children. And then you get the, you know, Ben Gavirs and those guys who say, no, you got to shoot the children too, it doesn't matter, just shoot whatever crosses the line on site. And that seems to be the position that they've adopted. So it's not just like military age males. Anybody who encroaches, again, on a line that exists on a map and maybe is marked in some places, but you know, I don't know that it's well delineated on the ground, so that somebody who's walking around in the rubble that used to be Gaza and maybe trying to get back to what remains of their home would know when they've crossed this line. But they're, you know, instant target at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we should probably head to the other side of the paywall. Before we do, I want to give people some kind of sense for the treat that's in store for them on the other side of the paywall. You know, there's going to be a little bit of a ruckus between me and you two, because to get back to that Morgan Spector thing, okay, so I would just remind you that what he made the very sensible suggestion that maybe the American left should focus on getting on compliance with international law and building global respect for the norm of complying with international law and so on. And this leads to an exchange between you two that I'm about to play, and then we'll go to the other side of the paywall, and maybe after a little more discussion of Gaza, like, all hell will break loose over this. I mean, I do think, frankly, this is going to be the end of our friendship. This may be the end of the whole collaborative thing between us. I'm sorry.
Well, hold on. We're not friends. Just kidding.
Okay, so the friendship ended already, but the collaboration could end.
The synergistic
that's right.
That's happening here.
Yeah. It's going to go
from
win-win.
Before we do, everyone subscribe, especially you freeloaders.
Well, I'm going to play this on this side of the paywall. Like the bait. That's going to get them on the edge of their seat.
It's a tease.
I mean, I'm probably revealing too much about our masterful strategy here, but that's the idea. If you are a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero newsletter or the American Prestige podcast and media empire, you will get access to what's about to happen in addition to all kinds of other goodies. Is that correct? But yeah, now I'm going to...
That is correct.
Here comes the bait, okay? This is what transpired near the end of your Morgan Spector podcast.
Major problem in American history.
I mean, it was very much a missed opportunity in the 90s, I think. And Danny, you and I have talked about this before, that for the people who really claim to care about the, you know, so-called values, American values, human rights, and democracy, and all of these things, that was the moment to cede the sovereignty, to cede the power to an international body that could institute those things as norms and actually, you know, work to make them a reality in the world. But we decided it would just be easier for the United States to be a world police. And that was it. That was the end of that moment.
And that was the period Bob was politicized in. So that's why he's very committed to it. Everyone's just historically situated. History, the greatest discipline. Morgan, thank you so much for joining us, man. This was one of the best episodes.
So dope, right? Yeah. Really, really.
Interesting that you usher him on stage as soon as he starts, off stage as soon as he starts saying favorable things. Anyway, I want to, paywall coming up, but first I just want to compliment you, both of you, really, on setting a new record for like amount of confusion per second in a podcast segment. Okay? Is that
paywall? Yeah, that's good tease. No,
that's good. Okay.
Paywall
all right,
now.
Folks,
all right.
You're not going to get this for free. Okay, but thanks to everybody who is not going to follow us into overtime. But you may regret it.
Yeah, thanks for nothing.
Went down there. Yeah. 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 Excellent. Excellent. Excellent public relations there, Danny. Okay.